1, back to number 1, back to number 1. And to me, that had a lot to do with what happened in the passing game in quarter 2, quarter 3. My other thing was I feel like from Virginia Tech's standpoint, I thought their offensive coordinator lost his and we've seen this with our own offensive staff, is their play calling stamina. To me, the combination of those two backs, especially number 45, that kid, although I thought he had some limitations, he is a physical back. He is a
leader.
He
was killing us. That fullback was crushing us.
Right, and like Hurd, he is one of those backs where if you just keep feeding him, eventually that defense is, they don't want to see him anymore. And I thought then at that point, it was almost like they could have picked a play. But I thought when they got down, here, I think I wrote down 14-7, Tennessee goes up 24-14, then you could see their play calling change. To me, that's where they lost a little bit of their discipline. They went away from him and they turned it into a small man's game. But I thought they had Tennessee kind of right where they wanted them. My pregame scouting report was that Tennessee, probably they don't hold up to the run like I would see them, or like I would want to see them hold up to the run in the interior. I think our linebackers get caught up in some of these combo blocks up to the second level. Reeves, Nabin, and Kirkland, you know, trying to shed blocks and, you know, get to the runner. And so when they went away from that, I thought that their offensive coordinator lost his discipline a little bit into that second and third quarter to help us out. So I think between those three things, Dobbs, heavy dose of Hurd, and just their offensive coordinator just getting off that game plan that we saw that first quarter and a half, I think those were the three things that were the game changers for this game.
You know what's funny about them? Russell, they don't like running the football. That their head coach absolutely abhors running the football. You talk to Memphis people, they'll tell you that. Fuente do not run the ball.
No.
But tonight, they ran the ball 45 times for 238 yards. Wow. They netted 186 because they ended up losing.
Wait. Virginia Tech ran for 238
Virginia
yards?
Virginia Tech ended up running for 186 yards net after all that. But they rushed the ball 45 times to our 46. And here's the point Jerry's making. Once we started disguising what we were doing and then we got up a score and a half on them, they got out of being who they were.
Well, they were blowing us off the ball in the first half.
There is no doubt about that.
Knocking Tennessee back. And
Jerry, that was concerning, wasn't it? The way they were. Somebody brought it up earlier. It's like we are a step slow to a step and a half slow coming out of the locker room two games in a row.
I don't know. I don't think it's an intensity thing. I don't think it's an effort thing. I think if you really go back and look at this team, and even when I saw this team in person, because I haven't seen them in person, practice or scrimmage or anything like that, but I did see them this summer. Our linebackers aren't what I would call NFL sized linebackers.
No, they're light. Mm-hmm.
Right. So to me, if I'm playing Tennessee, especially if they don't have two big space eaters right there in the middle, I'm going to run right at them, and I know that if my center and guards are pretty good, I know I can help that center out, double team one of those tackles and get on up to the second level, and I will swallow up Reeves and Kirkland every single time. And I think that's what we saw in that first quarter and a half, but they went away from that.
If you got to put Reeves, Maven, Dubs at linebacker, which is, I guess, what we're thinking in the short term here with...
At middle.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that create another conundrum? Because then now all of a sudden, I mean, you're not deep there, and Jerry's got a good point. It isn't like you're huge there, especially without Kirkland on the field.
Well, I mean, I don't know that Kirkland is that much bigger than Jalen Reeves-Maybin.
Which is a great point.
So, I mean, I would put Maybin in the middle, and then you've got McDowell, who played a lot last week at the outside. I think he's a junior now, so he's got a lot of experience. And then Quarte Sapp, who's a redshirt freshman or a sophomore, I don't know if he redshirted last year, that they're really high on. So, I mean, get him some experience.
People have been asking about Dylan Bates tonight. Now, Dylan Bates is on the sheet of having played tonight. On the final stats, Dylan Bates is in the soup.
He plays special teams every game, and he might have gotten in. I don't know. I was driving over here in that last drive where Virginia Tech scored, so he might have been in there.
Right. But he's, in terms of him playing regularly, I would not hold my breath on that. Let's go back. And somebody's saying here, Fuente Jerry has to be looking back on his game management tomorrow when they look at that film. And he's not going to like what he sees because he let that game get away from them, really.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, he can't hold on to the dang ball for him.
Well, that's a great point, too.
That was the difference. Tennessee won by 21 points. They scored 21 points off turnovers,
that's,
if you do the math.
No question. Let's get our next call in. On your Smartway Garza Law Firm fifth quarter fan reaction. Remember, it's Smartway. You can go smartway.net. See why Smartway is different. Seven distinct advantages. From simple approval process to loyalty rewards.
I think I'm about to be on.
You're on. Yeah, give me 1 second here. Smartway 8416 Kingston Pike. Go smartway.net. Go ahead, my friend. Yeah, you're on.
Tony.
Yes, sir.
Tony.
Yes, sir.
Hey, this is Taylor. Listen, we're up here at, we've been up at the Medallion Campground.
Uh-huh.
Thursday, evening. This place has been crazy. I just want to say, you know, I keep hearing all these callers complain, but we ought to enjoy this a little bit. I mean, these moments have been fleeting over the last decade, and we ought to enjoy this win a little bit. My gosh, Tony, I mean, my gosh, it seems like a funeral I'm listening to here over the last couple hours here. And I appreciate your show, but my goodness.
I think you're right.
Enjoy it for what it is.
I think you're right, but here's the thing. It's almost like we have, there was a level of expectation coming into this year that this team would play clean and crisp and championship level football. And I think people are alarmed that they've come out of the tunnel twice in a row under Butch Jones, and we haven't seen that in his tenure. Which is
no doubt about.
But that was scary tonight. What I saw in the first half was kind of scary.
Yeah.
But I think you're right.
Listen,
we're 2-0. How many teams would trade places with us? To your point, Taylor.
Absolutely. Look at last week. I mean, my gosh, there were a lot of good teams that got beat last week, Tony. This week is the same way. Even though there were a lot of terrible games out there, we ought to enjoy this for what it is. I see that, you're right. I wish we would have started stronger. I wish we would have finished stronger in some of these games. Tonight, we got a nice victory over what I think is probably a decent team. And, it's a good feeling. We ought to enjoy this for what it is. We move on 2-0. This is a great start. We couldn't ask for anything more at this point.
Nope. No question. Thanks, man. Great talking to you.
Appreciate it, Tony.
Great phone call, Taylor. Let's get our next call in. And our final couple of the night is we're 3 hours and 15 minutes in, and there's only so much oil in the ground. Let's get our next call in. Hello and welcome.
How's it going, Tony?
Hey, doing great. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm over here. This is Davis out in Nashville. I'm a little hoarse. Was out at the bar yelling and screaming with a bunch of ball fans.
You got to live it, brother. You got to live it.
That's right, man. It's a good time. I think I'm the only one not super drunk tonight. I was the designated driver, so we had a good time listening to these friends of mine go crazy and all that. But I've just got a couple observations, a good one and then a couple bad ones.
Go ahead.
So the good thing is that, you know, not every team this year that we face, and very few of them, are going to put the ball on the ground five times. And I think we all realize that and realize that, you know, that was a rare opportunity that we had tonight that we were able to capitalize on. But I liked that they put the ball on the ground five times, and we put it on the ground two times, for a total of seven times on the ground, and we got all seven. That just shows good awareness of our football team.
Yes.
And it's just a good effort. We didn't miss an opportunity on a fumble.
It is the hallmark of a winning team that you will give me a mistake, and I will take it, Jerry, and I will convert it. That's a hallmark of a winning team. It's also the hallmark of a winning team that I will make a mistake, as Tennessee did in overtime last week, and you're going to make mistakes in college football, against App State, and number one, who's down from your area, of this great state we live in, had the presence of mind to get on that football. And let me tell you something. There were a couple other people that had better shots at it, if you go back and watch that highlight, and he ends up on the ball. Why? Because he does not quit on plays, talking about Hurd, and he's completely paying attention. He's completely locked in to the moment. And I'm going to tell you, man, if he doesn't get that, we're talking about a completely different deal. And so a great point you bring up there. There's a lot of discipline showed by the football team here in the first two games.
Absolutely. Couple points that I didn't like so much. And our defense is fast, and they play pretty good, pretty smart football. They're good at making adjustments throughout the game. And, I mean, after that first quarter, you know, up until the garbage time there, we held them to 3 points. So don't want to be hard on the defense. They're great. But we really need to get our fundamentals down on tackling. You know, against App State, those are small guys.
Yeah.
You know, tonight we got a lot of breaks with the fumbles and just really bad ball handling.
Yeah.
But when we get into the SEC portion of our schedule, those guys are going to run right through the tackles that we're making.
Let me ask Jerry that.
Them.
Jerry, you coached at that SEC level. Is this gentleman right?
I think there's something to what he's saying, especially I think also take a look at who they're playing. So, who are our next three SEC opponents? We got Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. Is it in that order?
A&M.
I don't have
A&M.
Yes. A&M, not so much, because they're going to be, they're a lot like Tennessee, a lot of one back, where their tight end don't play attached to the line of scrimmage. You'll see the tight end lined up kind of in the backfield off the hip of the tackle. So that'll be more of a finesse game. But if you take the Florida game, you take the Georgia game, and the Alabama game, those games will be where there'll be some finesse, but you'll also see a heavy mix of just pure old school style football. Some of what they do is reminiscent of you know, what we've seen in the past. And I think, like we saw tonight, and we're talking about what happened in the earlier part of this game. I still don't know if it's Tennessee's strong suit to just line up and play against another team that has a physical style, traditional style, pro style, running attack. So I kind of agree with this caller here, and it'll be, if I'm watching Tennessee the first couple of games, especially, Appalachian State, where they ran a whole bunch of two back, type direct runs right at us. Our guys couldn't hold up in the middle.
Do you think Nashville caller, it's because we don't practice against it? We don't see it? Because we never, you know, they never show it to them in practice.
They never show what to them?
We don't do two back stuff. Butch Jones doesn't believe in it. So, can that be part of this?
You know, it could be. I don't know. I'm not, you know, an expert on this. It just seems to me like we're missing. We have opportunities to get the guys in the backfield or at the line of scrimmage, and it seems like more often than not, we're letting those guys get away with just little arm tackles, you know, just slowing people up. And there's more often than not, it takes two or three of our people to get their guy to the ground.
Yeah.
That's going to be a real problem when you get against, you know, someone like Chubb.
Yeah, and Tony, to add to the caller's comment here, I think a lot of that is reps, you know, the kind of reps that you're seeing. You know, if you're a Tennessee defense and the offense that you're playing against the whole training camp is, you know, a one-back set offense, tight ends in the backfield or tight end split, tight ends never attached to the line of scrimmage in a 3-point stand, blocking on the run game, I kind of agree with you here in that it almost gets our, in a negative way, it gets our defense, the front, accustomed to playing a more of a finesse style. You go into that 3-4 game stretch where three out of those four opponents play a totally different style. It's more of a, old SEC, Big Ten style, football than that. It's almost like a shock to their system. So I would kind of agree with you there. I mean, you make a great point in that, you know, how do you even rep that in practice, to simulate it during the summertime?
Yeah, how do you simulate it when you don't use it yourself? That's my point. And that's, but thanks, man. Thanks in Nashville. Great talking to you. Anything else?
Well, I'd say the one other thing is for me, have a huge question mark. I know there's been plenty of discussion on the coaching, but there's some real concerns for me with Butch Jones, someone who's coming and really done a great job as far as recruiting goes.
Agreed.
And turning the team around. But I think that, it's this season, it's remarkable to me the low level of excitement and hype and energy brought by the Tennessee Volunteers football team. And I wonder how much of that is because of kind of Butch's seemingly soft nature this season, of even how last week, not apologizing for that win and whatever his vernacular was. But if you look at a coach like Saban, who's out there, yelling at his guys when they screw up, and he's really engaged, and it's a risk reward thing.
Can I say this to you? And I think one thing I tried to do this year, and I'm not telling you how to think. You can do it.
Sure.
Do whatever you want to do. What a guy says to the press, what he says to his football team, and Jerry can talk to this, are two completely different things. In other words,
Coach speak.
Butch Jones can come to before the press and say, now I disagree with him saying this, because last week what he should have said, and Dr. Sean Sinclair is right, who we have on Wednesdays, what Butch Jones should have said last week after that game on Thursday night is, you know what, we had people drive from the four corners of the state tonight for this game, and it means a lot to people, and we really appreciate your support. Without your support, I don't have this job. Without your support, I feel blessed every day to get up and serve you, and I'm a caretaker of this program. I want to apologize to our fan base for the way that we played tonight. It was not acceptable. That's what he should have said. Now, he's never going to say that. This guy is never going to be that guy. He's just not. He's not secure enough for whatever reason. Here's the thing. Behind the scenes, I can promise you that they read those guys the Riot Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that behind the scenes, he told them, we didn't coach you well enough. He's never going to say that publicly because he's not confident enough. I'm just telling you. Behind the scenes, he said, we didn't coach you well enough, and you guys didn't play well enough. And you guys think you arrived, and you haven't done anything. You upperclassmen think because you won 9 games last year, you haven't accomplished anything. And I'm just telling you, that's what happened in the locker room. There's no way he went to them after that game and said, guys, any win's a good win, and we're not going to apologize for winning a game. Now, get your shower and, get off and go and enjoy yourself tonight. You have the tomorrow off because we won tonight. There's no way that's what happened. I mean, I'm just telling you that there's no way. Russell, do you agree with that? And Jerry, do you agree with that? Russell,
yes.
You first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had to have known that was a pitiful performance, and I'm sure that they worked with, especially with the extra time, I bet they were hitting a little bit this week and
yes,
cranking it up a notch.
And they blast jobbed their team. There's no question behind closed doors. Jerry, do you agree with what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I guess the thing is I don't quite understand it is this. I almost feel like, all right, well, if you reverse engineer this thing,
right?
What's the point? I don't get what's the psychological advantage of trying to shoulder that burden for the way your team played. I mean, I don't think they have those perennial expectations on them yet, where they've already gone out and done something immaculate the previous year, and now they're coming back and trying to repeat it. So the fact that he went out and made that statement last week was a little bit odd to me, being that really, you know, this team is a team still trying to really go out and win that first signature season, and, you know, make a dent in the East. So
he's just never going to be that guy. I mean, I don't care what kind of equity he gets. He's never going to. He's just never going to be that guy. He's just not. And, hey, Nashville, I appreciate your call, but trust me, behind the scenes, he blasted them, okay? I mean, you trust me on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Have a great day.
Absolutely, Tony. Appreciate the show, man.
Hey,
thank you.
And here's the other thing. You know, look, Saban, they win by 4 touchdowns, and he's bitching about what they didn't do.
Did you hear what he said today?
What?
They won like 38-3, and his quote was, "I don't think I've ever been as disappointed after a win as I am today."
There you go. Pat Summitt, it was never enough for her. Pat Summitt, they would beat people by 60. And she'd go to that press conference and go, "Look, here's what you saw, and you want to celebrate that. Here's what I saw." And then she would blast people. Let's get our next call in. Hello and welcome. Our final call of the evening, because I'm simply out of gas. Hello and welcome in.
Is this me?
Yes, go right ahead, please. You're our final call tonight.
Awesome. Tony, I love, like, I'm in Virginia now. Mm-hmm. You know, I was part of the student body in the 90s, early, mid-90s, where we were spoiled as fan
spoiled, base. Spoiled, so spoiled.
And, yeah, no, and you know what? We didn't even understand what we had.
No.
And like, I really think, as a fan base, and I'll get to the game if you give me my time, that I'm not glad that we've struggled this long for almost a decade, but we became so spoiled where we didn't even understand how good we were. And now I think we need to understand how good we were. But what I want to say about what you know, everyone wants to always blame coaches for everything and not execution with the players. Like, the players never have any, like, we love to blame Butch. We want to blame Mike DeBoard. We want to do Shoop. You got to play. And players got to execute. But once we made the difference on the offensive line and Shoop's defensive line started dominating, and Tuttle is a beast. Hello?
No, I'm listening to you, man. I tell you what I like about you.
here comes the punchline.
You got juice.
But what I'm saying, I mean, when we made, we did make everyone.
Here's what I'd say to you on the whole thing about criticizing kids. First of all, the coaches make the money. That's why they get criticized. That's one. Second thing is, and just hear me out here, is I love your take. I love your energy. And in fact, I want some of it. But the thing that I don't understand is, why wasn't Jones in that game first? I mean, it was so, like, obvious to the naked eye, right? He comes in and all of a sudden they're moving the football. They're pounding people. They're running it under him. I mean, and then DeBoard, I'm a big shot taker at DeBoard, because that what they do drives me nuts. I've got receivers that are taller than my defenders, and I've got receivers who have ball skills, as my man Jerry Colquitt likes to say. And I won't throw the ball up to my receivers that have ball skills. Now, I've done that twice in 2 games. Okay, now you help me out here, because you don't want
to
blame the coaches.
Have we not thrown the ball up to the receivers?
No, we haven't. We've attempted two passes. Hang on. We've attempted 2 passes of longer than 30 yards. And what happened on both of them this year? Let's see how good you are.
Both were touchdowns.
Okay. Why in the hell aren't we throwing more balls to those receivers?
You know why?
Tell me why.
No. I'm not disagreeing with you. I want to do.
No, tell. I want you to tell me why. Since it's the kid's fault, tell me why.
No, because the pass protection has been so bad.
I don't care. That makes no sense. That they're not even attempting to do it, which is the point.
No. But once we changed the line, to me, this game changed on.
That's exactly right.
Once we changed the offensive line,
that's right.
The personnel and the defensive front started hammering people again.
Now that's a great point. Here's where I'm at. Why wasn't the Jones kid, who played real well last year, why wasn't he in there to begin with?
Well, you know what? I only have to look, and this is my, and I'm not. But I think what they want to do is they want to see who is best in practice all the time.
Okay. You know what you want to say? You and me are the same.
I say, who's best in the game?
You got it. And Jerry, coaches love that whole practice thing, which is why I think Colton Jumper keeps getting on the field. I got news for you. God bless that kid. White Lightning, he can't play in games. God bless
him. He's not like...
It's like putting me out there. It's like putting
enough.
No, that's right. It's like putting me. And look, I'm a great guy. I'll talk your ear off about it, and I'll make you think.
No, but you know what? If we're going to complain about a 3-touchdown win,
I'm not complaining.
No, not you, Tony.
Right.
But we're the world. I love our fan base.
I love our fan base. So passionate.
But we are so negative about everything. We win by 3 touchdowns,
yeah.
And I'm not saying we don't have stuff to improve upon, but once they made that change on the offensive line, and the defensive line in Tuttle is a monster.
He's a bad man, dude.
He is a bad man.
He is a, and let me tell you something. What is he right now? 75%? What do you think he's playing, Russell?
Yeah,
nah, probably 80.
75.
80? 80? Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I said less than that.
I agree with you, Jerry. And what happens when he gets to 110%, guys?
Right.
Like he was last year.
Dominates.
I mean, the guy from Florida, some people think cheap shot at him. Do you think it was cheap shot, Russell?
From Georgia? No, I mean, Georgia. Yeah, oh yeah,
Georgia.
That was a cheap shot. Yeah.
Okay. That guy, when Tennessee goes down there this year, is going to be on the ticket.
Was it the Georgia guy that went and hurt him?
Yeah, it was Georgia. Yeah. I'm sorry. Shy Tuttle. And it's the guy's name I can't pronounce.
Poblano.
Shy Tuttle, when they go down there and sees that this guy's face is on the picture for the Tennessee game, is going to go He's going to go nuts in that game. Okay,
but I think that once again, I think the thing it was the line. Our offensive defensive line started to dominate.
Yeah, and you know what else they did tonight, Jerry, from a coaching standpoint? The defensive coordinator, Jerry, started disguising their blitz and where it was coming from, and they had those guys totally discombobulated. They were run blitz and pass blitz, and they were mixing all their stuff up. They were doing some exotic things, and then they smelled blood.
I don't disagree with you, Tony, but the thing was the defensive line just started getting penetration every single snap.
I think a lot of that is due to what we said earlier. You know, to me, some of these out of conference teams, the one mistake that we alluded to earlier that they have made is don't make it a small man game against this Tennessee defense. This Tennessee defense last year and this year, you're probably going to be able to run against them, but you got to stay disciplined throughout the whole game. To me, the minute that, about a quarter and a half into this game, I'm looking at my notes. I got a bunch of negatives, and I put PC play calling. They went away from what they were doing well early on. I even heard, kind of frustrating, you know, when I got home, I was listening to the playback, and to hear Kirk Herbstreit get on that, go, oh, these guys got to really up the tempo. Why? I think at that point it's what, a little bit left to go in the first quarter. The momentum has shifted, but at that point, you know, you don't have to start hurrying up and doing anything different than what made you successful the whole first quarter. So
the bottom,
me,
yeah. The bottom line is, Jerry, well, the bottom line to everything that y'all are saying is, it is about players, because if Tech doesn't turn that ball over when they're up 14-0, I shudder to think of what kind of game we're talking about here.
And that's true.
That's freaky. I mean, that was really freaky how the game just turned.
And Tony,
It was almost like a bowl game.
Yes, it was. Because once the Avalanche started happening, and that's a sign of a great team.
How quick it is.
It was it.
The only thing is, we didn't tackle well.
No, we didn't. And that's a point several people have brought up. That's the thing that scares me about this team is our offensive line play and our tackling. We do not look like a physical Southeastern Conference football team at times.
But I think we have, but after the first quarter, we were physical.
I agree with that.
We started to flash it a little.
We did. Because they started to feel that blitz. They were swarming there.
But you can't just flash and beat Florida and Georgia. You're going to get it for four quarters.
If you play that.
I will tell you one thing. This has been a Tennessee hallmark forever, at least this is what drives me crazy, is we want to lay the big hammer down and we won't tackle. We want to hit instead of tackling. And there's a difference.
I love the way you enunciate your words. Sir, you could read the phone book to me and I'd listen. You're pumping me up right now. It's like 4
but
o'clock. You're pumping me up.
But I really, yeah, no, Tony. I love being on your show. You're jacking me up.
No, you're jacking me up, and I need to get jacked down.
But the fact is we want to hit somebody.
He just butted you like 3 times in a row.
I know, right?
But keep going. We listen.
But we want to hit and not tackle.
You're like the fifth person that said that. You're exactly right. And here's the thing. The thing I go back to is when I look at that App State team that played us last week, brother.
That App State team
they
will be
tackled.
In the top 5 by the end of the
they
year.
They tackled. They didn't hit. The first guy that touched them, they wrapped you up. They weren't there to make the highlight film. They were there to make the tackle. And by the way, Jalen Reeves-Maven was really close tonight, Dubsy, to another helmet-to-helmet.
Yeah, he
better
was.
Be really careful. He needs to
super
get down.
Close. He was super close.
Super close. I mean, he needs to get down.
Your senior leader.
And make tackles.
Captain of your defense.
Worrying about blowing somebody up. Make a tackle.
Can I ask you guys two quick questions?
Yes, as long as you don't use butt.
Okay, so... this is on Reeves-Maven, and I jotted this down. And I wanted to get you guys feedback on this. But,
go ahead.
The open field play where the quarterback kind of leaves him standing. He makes a juke on him. He slips by him. There was another play where I think it was, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon McWilliams. Trayvon McWilliams.
That makes sense for me.
Yeah, and he stutter steps him and made him almost fall to the ground. And then I think it was almost like a series of two after that.
He did fall down, right?
Well, he did fall down. He did fall down.
A series of two after that, Reeves-Maven then goes in and flies in over the pile. So I'm wondering here, what is it about this kid because it's not a talent standpoint, but to me, when I see things like this and a guy who has so much talent, as far as being a sideline top, linebacker, that play that he made, the helmet-to-helmet hit, and then these two plays where he gets kind of just stuck in the middle field with no better play than that from him, and then he goes in and makes that bonehead play. Does that bother you guys?
Yes.
It bothers me a little
bit. Yeah, it bothers me. He's not off to and that's the point the caller was making earlier.
Yeah, I don't think it's like he bothers me. It's more like I think he's
He's trying to do too much.
Right.
But that can't be good when we come down this late September, October stretch.
You'll get beat doing that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
You're fine. I love your exuberance, man. You're talking over me too because you're Italian or whatever, and I love that.
No, I don't mean to talk over you.
That's fine. I love it. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. You can run. let me tell you something. You could run over me right now and beat the hell out of me with a stick, and I'd probably enjoy it. So go ahead.
I still find that the wide receivers are not catching the balls.
That's unbelievable.
They're still missed. I mean, and I hate talking about after we beat a team by 21.
Right.
After we were down 14-0.
Right.
But we have, I mean, Preston Williams in the first game. We still have wide receivers that are missing catches that are catchable.
Josh Smith dropped the ball tonight right in his hands. You can't do that. I mean, you just can't. If you're gonna beat people that matter on your schedule, Tessie's gotta play crisper, cleaner football, or this season is not going to work out. It's just not.
And
the quarterback's
is,
gotta
I'm
be better.
Gonna, but, right, and you're right. But I'm like, I don't wanna like, you know, hammer stuff, you know.
No, but it's true. No, but what you're saying, you're not hammering. Look, you can say, I love that we're 2-0. The team showed a lot of moxie and guts tonight, come back 14 down. It's true. You can also say, if they don't play a better, cleaner brand of football, they are not going to get past Florida. And by the way, they're not. They're just not.
And I agree with you, but like, you know, Georgia barely beats Nickel State, right?
No, it's college football. There's no question. It's college football.
And Appalachian State's 10 times the team that
right.
They beat it by 40.
I'm going to tell you something else. People laughed at me earlier. I want your opinion because I like you. I really do. I think Appy State would beat the living hell out of Virginia Tech.
I think it would be tough.
No, Tech doesn't value the ball. Appy State would eat them alive.
Well, they don't. Well, this is the thing, is Fuente's offense, they want to run a lot of, like, strange, hide the ball, and they want to, and when you hike the ball and you have people everywhere, it's a very dangerous thing. Like, if you saw, interesting enough, Saban chewed Kiffin out today.
Yes, he did.
Because they were just trying to run the game out, and he's trying to run some kind of stupid thing instead of just running the ball.
Yep.
And because of the ball, then they fumbled the ball, and I actually lost the $500, but whatever, because I lost by half a point. Because of the same thing, instead of just running the ball, they want him to, like, run the, you know, they hike the ball and all this shit goes on. Excuse my language. I apologize.
After dark, baby.
But that's exactly
hey, Tone.
Yeah, babe.
That was kind of my thought was, just think about it. Now, this team is having all this success in the first quarter.
What are we doing?
quarter and a half, Virginia Tech. And they're just pounding it with Rodgers and McWilliams. And think about it. This game was lost on what kind of play? On a doggone stupid jet sweep fake.
I get it.
What did you call plays in Virginia? All these shit that's going on. That is a great way of putting it. No, it's true. These newfangled offenses. See, I play a lot of music, okay? And I've been playing out a whole bunch. And when you play out, you play with different people. My favorite players are the ones that play what belongs in a song. The guys I can't stand playing with, I'm going to tell you something about music. The guys I can't stand playing with are the guys that have to get their shit in. That's what we call it.
What?
And now you listen to me. They have to show you how fast their fingers move.
How bad they are.
And how great, exactly, and how great they are. And they play a bunch of stuff that doesn't belong in a song. And Russell, you've played with people like that. And that's what these spread coaches are. It's like, I'm got
they
some.
They prove how beautiful they are, how much they
exactly.
Know.
I've got something that's working here. He's called my fullback. And I'm going to keep giving him the ball. Like Tim Priest said tonight when we were driving home. He said, why?
Apple. I mean,
he's next level. Yeah. He said, why did they go away from that? Just like Jerry said. Because these guys know
see
football.
That Broncos fullback score a touchdown Thursday night?
Hello.
And defenders ran right
like,
by him?
Why would you, if I got something that's working, I'm going to do it till you stop it. But this guy's got to get his jet sweeps in. He's got to get his action in. He's got to. And then what do? We've taken our quarterback now, and then you couple that with what our defensive coordinator's done, and now I've got you totally screwed up because you don't know where the blitz is coming from. There's five guys on top of you. They're on your jock, like the co-eds were on Jerry Colquitt when he was on campus. And what are we doing? Right?
Yeah, no.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, no, and you know what? And I like Shute because he makes adjustments.
Absolutely.
And he makes them quick.
He does. He's a lot like our offensive coordinator. He doesn't make adjustments, and he doesn't make them quickly.
But you know what? And you're right, Tony.
He drives me nuts.
But sometimes I think if you trust your players,
right,
you do what you do.
Right. Listen, I love you. You love me. We fit the air like a family. It's like Barney. Thanks, man. Have a Dwight Gooden. I love your energy. I want to tap into you. In 3 hours, can you call me? We'll have a transfusion. Will you do that when I wake up? Jerry, on the way out, give me a final thought because I'm exhausted. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, can I get a question and then my final thought?
No.
Hey, man. Come on,
go
man.
Go ahead. Get a question, Jerry. Get a question.
All right. My question for you and Dubsy here is this. Is it concerning at all the number of hits that Josh Dobbs, even though we know Josh Dobbs just on his own as an athlete, can pull some stuff out of his behind to help this team when it seems like nothing else is really going right at the right moment? Are either one of you concerned about just the number, the flips?
Oh God!
You
know what I'm putting in my blog on Monday? Josh Dobbs on that one play where he tumbled over and smashed his neck. You know what he looked like, Dubsy? A crash test dummy.
I would try.
That's not good.
I would make an effort to get Quentin Dormady a couple of series in the first half against Ohio.
No question.
And let him run the offense. Let him throw it around a little bit. Get him some meaningful experience. For that, to get him some experience, but also to limit the number of exposures Dobbs is out there for.
And the reason I ask that is this season, almost the way it's been playing out, is just like last year. To me, Josh is an excellent athlete, and he just kind of has that it factor. When everything else breaks down, he's one of those three or four key guys that you can count on happening, regardless of how the game is being called, how they're performing on offense, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time,
I would get Dobbs some rest.
Right. And to me, it's like somewhere in early October, it's about mid-October, this guy
is going to run the gauntlet. Give him a couple weeks ago. Give him a couple weeks off. I mean, a couple of series off next week and let the kid play some quarterback. Hey, listen, Jerry, I love you, man. I appreciate you so much. I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate your twistedness. I appreciate everything about you, brother.
Thanks, man. Back to you, Tony. I know you guys have had a long day, but, man, I was excited for this one. Did a lot of film study.
Good.
Came home, reviewed the game. Notes.
Good. And I failed you. Next week we'll get you on earlier.
Yeah, and hey, I just want to say thanks to a bunch of these people that came out tonight at Canterbury to watch the game.
Thank you.
I wish I would have gotten a contact info for one of the people. There was a girl from East Tennessee who her and her husband, they just got married. Mm-hmm. They're going on an Alaskan cruise. They looked up where they can go watch a Tennessee football game.
That's neat.
They found our group. She goes, oh, man, I know who you are. VFL, and, having a VFL shirt on from Anton Davis, the great
now,
Anton.
Who did she think you were, Jerry? Tell the truth.
Probably Marcus Allen.
Why?
Or Billy D. Williams.
I guess it's better to be confused for Marcus Allen than OJ.
Or A.C. Collins. But I said, no, I said I'm Jerry Colbert. Oh, she goes, I know who you are. Oh, boy, so, I mean, you guys have no idea. This Big Orange family extends all the way to the opposite side of the United States, and my most favorite part of this day was, I picked my daughter up, after she had her soccer game. We were on the way to the Tennessee party. And she said, Dad, I said, are they going to play Rocky Top? I said, yes, sir.
Your daughter's so precious, man. And you giving her life and, adopting her and bringing him, man, you're just such a great man. Jerry, I love you. Thanks. You're killing me though. Take care, brother.
Hey, hold on, man.
That was his question. Now he has his final thought.
Jerry, it's 4 effing a.m.
And you extended this dude before me for like 20 minutes, and then you're going to cut me short, you know, 45 minutes.
There are roosters crowing outside.
5.
They're all going to 4, the Waffle House.
3. 2. Jerry, thanks. Love you.
All right, man. See you.
Good night. Dubsy. Love you.
That'll do it.
Thanks, brother. Tell them where they can find you this week.
Fox Sports Knoxville, 1340 a.m. here in town. Online at foxsportsknoxville.com. I'm on weekdays from 3 to 6.
And you do a hell of a job.
Oh, thanks.
You're excellent at Sometimes. What you do. You're excellent at what you do. 3 hours and 50 minutes later. It's a lot of fun tonight. Jerry, you are a black helicopter sheep. Till we meet again for all those behind the scenes. Hey, it was a lot of fun. Thanks to all that came to our listener watch party. Y'all are unbelievable. Thank you to my friends at Miller Lite for providing. We're going to have several more listener watch parties throughout the year. Next one is the Georgia game. Until we meet again, I'll be back on the radio with you on Monday at 11 a.m. And you'll be able to find me right here at TonyBasilio.com as well. Check our blog out as well. Tons of stuff. All free. Until we meet again, to my Eagles, I say go to 2-14. We love you. God bless. Lover, you're in the right spot. And you remember that era from the late 80s into the early 90s when it came out of Seattle, and boy, did it come hard out of Seattle. Nick Soulsby is now joining here on Book Corner. His book, I Found My Friends, The Oral History of Nirvana. And Nick, the first thing I want to do when I welcome you in here is say, tremendous job by you in putting this together. I was telling you before we got started, you know, I really didn't know a lot about Nirvana, and I really didn't pay all that much attention to what was happening in Seattle when this was all going on back in the 90s. I'm so glad I picked your book up, though, because you really told an interesting story in a great way. Congratulations to you.
Thank you very much. It's just an honor to get to talk about a subject I enjoy.
Obviously, as we tell and we get started here, I just want to let folks know a little bit about your background here. First of all, Nick Soulsby is also an author of Dark Slivers, Seeing Nirvana in the Shards of Incesticide. Also blogs on his website, nirvanalegacy.com. Also, Nick helped arrange the release of No Seattle, Forgotten Sounds of the Northwest Grunge Era, a compilation of bands featured in I Found My Friends. And Nick's currently working on Cobain on Cobain for the Musicians in Their Own Words series. Nick, obviously this is a point of passion for you, and it seems to me as if you're one of the keepers of the flame for Nirvana.
It's been funny to spend a couple of years, I mean it's a full several years now, embedded in something like this so deeply. And I think the most crucial thing for me has always been that I'm not a professional writer. That's not how I think of it. I have a normal day job that pays the bills. This is something I do because I actually love it, and I want my respect and enjoyment of the topic to come across. So it's always been about writing the book that feels right by the people involved, feels right by Nirvana, and hopefully encourages people to want to see more and learn more.
Speaking of learning, I was going to ask you this. I always love asking authors this question, especially guys like you that have a passion in particular point and place or a subject, And then I ask someone as yourself, and I'm always going to get an answer because we learn every day. What did you learn specifically about Nirvana from this oral history as you put it together? What snuck up on you about their story?
I think by the time I had to finish this book, the most important thing to me was to do proper homage by the people who'd given me their time. I increasingly got, as you talked to more and more musicians who played with Nirvana, I got this increasing sense of Cobain as this actually very popular guy who did have friends and who was surrounded by people who didn't just respect him but liked being around him. And by the time I finished, those were the people who I thought I owed a duty to. This was not just this famous superstar. This was their friend. This was a guy who was so poor, who was so broke. You know, there's a guy told me that he bumps into Cobain walking around Olympia sometime in mid-late 1991, and he's sort of tossing this apple up and down, and then she asks, "Oh, what's the apple?" And Cobain says, "It's the only food I've had for the last 3 days, so I'm saving it for when I'm really hungry." And this is the cusp. He's just about to become the world's most famous musician, and he has no idea it's coming, and he's so broke, all he's got is an apple. This is someone who goes from, you know, really being outside of the mainstream society. This is not someone pulling in wages from a regular job, and somehow he ends up on top of the world. And there is something inspiring about that.
There's something extremely inspiring about it. And I give you full disclosure here. I'm a depression sufferer, had several bouts with it in my adult life. And when it first happened to me, I didn't really realize what was happening. And now that I've come out on the other side of it several times, I really feel a sense of empathy for those that go through it, and I feel a real sense of empathy for people who get lost in whatever it is their excesses are, however they medicate themselves, and we all have different ways in this world. Kurt Cobain strikes me through your oral history of, it seems like, hundreds of interviews that you did for this, as just a really sweet-spirited, creative person who at times just wasn't comfortable in this world or comfortable in his skin. That's kind of what I got from Kurt Cobain.
That would sound very fair. I mean, my younger sister is 12 years younger than me, and she went through a spell of depression, and to try and explain that experience to someone who hasn't endured it, I can't imagine that's easy because people think of people in depression as still having the capacity to make rational decisions at all times. I think people underestimate the weight of what comes down on someone's mind when they go through that and how many options seem closed off or impossible and the effect that has on all their interactions. They often are demanding something of someone who isn't in a place where they can do that. But that doesn't mean that someone becomes, you know, just a crazy guy on dope or anything like that. Kurt Cobain was a deeply likable guy who is always struggling between this very polite, very social, very kind side to him and this other side that just wants to be left alone. And at some point, I guess it must have become hard to negotiate walking along that tightrope.
Plus, the brooding Kurt Cobain was a more marketable Kurt Cobain for the times. And there's a part in your book, and I forget where it happens, and I even forget who the musician is that's saying it, but still talking about Nirvana. This might have even been before Dave Grohl joins the group. And they're struggling, and they're on a tour of America, and Kurt looks at somebody and says, you know, I'm not going to be able to really show my personality or smile when we get there, because they like the... I forget how he put it or how you put it or whoever it was talking about it, but almost as if you've got to give people what they want in terms of what you're going to show the world, that exterior that you're going to show the world. And there was a part of that in here, kind of what they did with Jim Morrison with the Doors, kind of that dark mystery around him. But the picture we get from what you paint here is, here's a guy who behind the scenes, when he had his good days, would laugh, would joke around, was people-oriented to the folks he wanted to be people-oriented with. Seems like there's a real separation there as to who he purported to be, or from the media, from who he really was.
My feeling is always, I think people underestimate how divided any person is, that we're all like that. But when you put someone in front of a camera and you record their statements day after day, it becomes so obvious. If for someone like Kurt Cobain, being dissected to that degree and having those contradictions sort of pushed back toward him is a very confusing experience. And I don't think many of us experience that degree of exposure. I understand his friends get very confused now. Some of them will look at a film like The Montage of Heck that came out this year and say, that's not the friendly, cheerful guy I remember. But it doesn't mean it's untrue either. So when Kurt was on his own with people, he apparently was very open. He would smile. He would relax. There's a photographer who was the last guy to ever photograph the band. And he says he would have experiences where he'd be sitting talking with Kurt. Kurt would be fine. And then one or two other people would enter the room and Kurt would just retreat into the corner, would just go quiet. And there is that sense of someone who enjoyed that one-on-one connection with another human being. But when a group developed, just couldn't do that unless you're with people you really cared about and was really comfortable with. I'm not sure that's uncommon. There's always that line between learning that this guy was something exceptional and learning that he was also very normal in many ways.
Nick Soulsby is joining the book, I Found My Friends, The Oral History of Nirvana. And Nick, just along the way, puts a few words in here to keep the narrative going, but it's mostly musicians, support people, folks that were in the lives of Nirvana, folks who toured with them, folks whose voices probably haven't been heard in years, that Nick gives them an opportunity to talk about their experiences in music, their experiences with Nirvana. It is really well done. Nick, let me ask you, in your acknowledgement page, I'm trying to get a feel for how many folks you interviewed. And when I say page, it's four pages of names. It looks like there are hundreds of names there. How many interviews, how many hours compiling this?
I'd really regret that I didn't have the space to put in like a proper description of all the bands and all the individuals. So in the end, I spoke to members of 170 bands who played with Nirvana. And by my listings, I reckon they played with about 230 bands. Okay, I spoke to 170 of those. I spoke to 210 people, whether that just meant an email interview or whether that meant sitting down with them. You know, I did visit Seattle and sat down with certain people. I regret, in a way, not laying out clear at the beginning that my desire, there were so many books out there where people interview the same people again and again. It's the same superstars telling the same stories in a slightly different way. You're right in what you said earlier. My desire was to find these people who had played alongside a superstar or a future superstar and yet had never been asked their experience, who had never had that chance to say what it was like to rub shoulders or what they observed. And sometimes that just means what they observed was, okay, just a local bar band. And I quite liked that. After two decades of article after article calling them, you know, voice of the generation, band of the generation, best band of the 90s, best album of the 90s, just to come back to this more real experience that you or I could have stood in a tavern in Seattle in 1988 with only six other people, and that would have been Nirvana in front of us, and we would have been the only ones there. And that, getting back to that root and giving people that chance to speak up was what drove me on. It was a pleasure throughout. Just so many nice people sharing good stories.
It's interesting you talk about that bar band side of things, because that's what I really appreciated as well. There were several musicians quoted in here saying, look, I didn't even think Nirvana was the best band out of Seattle. I didn't get it. And yet you put that stuff in there. Have you had any backlash from the Nirvana-loving community? Not everything said in here is pedestal placing or positive, for that matter.
No, everyone seems pretty cool on that front. I think most fans, the true fans of Nirvana, are very comfortable with this yin-yang aspect, where this could be an amazing band or just a kind of average band. It wasn't a kind of work of God-given genius every night, and that seems comfortable. And I liked keeping in, you're right, there's quotes when people say all sorts of awful things about them, but I hope the things I kept in humanized them, made them real people who weren't always on good form, rather than making them into these sort of superhuman, untouchable beings. I quite liked the idea of having, you know, Chris Novoselic doing something petulant, Kurt Cobain being a pain in the neck one day. That appealed to me, to keep that balance, to make sure it wasn't hero worship.